The following program contains heavy spoilers, deep insight, and absolutely no filters. Listener discretion is advised.
Snobs on Film. My name is Arthur, your host, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Jahan and Isaac. Is this Us? Jordan Peele's Us, his second directorial effort, generated over $70 million for Universal Studios in its first few days of release. It is the first straight-ahead horror film that features a cast of black characters as the protagonists and shows how this family responds and questions their reality when faced with their doppelgangers, who are not very friendly, to put it mildly. In turn, the audience is encouraged to question our perceptions of ourselves and our society. So we're going to take a look at the rise of Jordan Peele, Barry Jenkins, and films like Sorry to Bother You, and wonder if people of color are being better represented by today's unconventional storytelling than by the hyper-realism of classics like Menace to Society and Boys in the Hood. So what do we mean by unconventional filmmaking?
I think there's different ways that you could be unconventional or non-standard in filmmaking. You could approach the story in that way, or you could approach the filmmaking in that way, the direction, the cinematography, etc. I think if we look at the directors that you've already mentioned, Jordan Peele, everybody knows, Get Out and Us, I would say he takes non-standard material, a non-standard story idea, and he perhaps depicts it in a standard enough way that a modern audience can digest it. I think in contrast to that, Barry Jenkins, director of Moonlight and the recent If Beale Street Could Talk, I think that he takes more standard material in terms of a story idea, but the vision that he lends that story is quite different and original, unconventional. And then finally, I guess, Boots Riley, who directed just one so far, Sorry to Bother You, so perhaps we can't judge him based solely on that. But that, for me, would be an out-and-out surrealist or almost absurdist film. So non-conventional all the way from story to everything else involved.
But, okay, so the name of the show is This Us, and Jay, you're the only one of us that's seen it so far. Obviously Arthur will see it and I won't, but does this film contain, even in the horror context, does it contain significant elements of surrealism and or satire?
Well, define surrealism.
It actually started as a movement, not just a straight ahead definition. So I wanted to read very quickly, quick definitions of the word that I think are apropos to this conversation. Surrealism, a 20th century avant-garde movement in art and literature, which sought to release the creative potential of the unconscious mind, for example, by the irrational juxtaposition of images. One could argue to actually tell the, authentic story of the experience of African-American people in America or people of color in the Western world, you kind of have to leap outside of the normal kind of confinement of thought that we have, because you could argue that our thought has been repressed, or our ideas or our ideologies or our freedom of expression has been oppressed in Western culture. So if you look at it in that context, then it's almost as if surrealism and satire are necessary. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have to have those things in order to combat against kind of the confinement of thought that's been imposed upon us. So I think that those things are interesting. Satire, Jay, I think maybe you should speak on satire, because I know you're a fan of satirical storytelling.
So you got nothing prepared?
Like, man, he just handed that off real smooth. Like, no preempting, nothing.
And no warning either. Like, it's here, like, bam, here's the baton. Now finish this race.
You don't have that Wikipedia page open?
You are my Wikipedia fan.
Highest compliment. I'll take it. So I guess satire for me is comedic style of art that looks to criticize society, politics, often, you know, current contemporary things.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like, you know, Dr. Strangelove, Wag the Dog, Thank You for Not Smoking. Those are all satires.
And then Spike Lee has used satire at times, right? I mean, not,
Bamboozled.
Maybe not straight ahead, but definitely, yeah, Bamboozled.
Bamboozled's the...
Yeah. What we're seeing now is a larger push in that direction, whether it be the horror, you know, in the horror context or in the somewhat comedy aspects of Sorry to Bother You. But again, the answer to the question that we posed a few minutes ago to me is that we should have both. I don't think that one of them does a better job necessarily of capturing.
That's the question, right? Which is more effective?
Yeah.
Rather than like we should choose one and only use one.
Right. That's what I say. I don't think that one is more effective. I think that both are necessary to get at the full scope.
Full scope of what? More effective of what?
Full scope of the narrative or the experience of people of color.
To tell our stories?
To tell our stories.
Right.
I think we need all the tools. You know, these are surrealism, satire, linear storytelling, mainstream, underground, whatever you want to call it, independent filmmaking, whatever all these things are tools. And I think we need all of them. To me, like what you guys are describing is a expansion or a growth of, you know, filmmaking possibilities for people of color, which is good. That's a positive. But have we left something behind? In other words, could Menace to Society be made in 2019? If I came with that script, am I going to get like, nah, this ain't If Beale Street Could Talk, or this isn't Sorry to Bother You, or this isn't even Creed. You know what I'm saying? This is some gangster shit and we not on that anymore.
Okay, but aside from the subject matter and the storylines, do you think that very real, very raw style of storytelling was effective?
Well, I think that it was a movie of its time. In other words, the zeitgeist at that moment was centered around that conversation, especially when you look at where hip hop was at that moment.
Yeah, the conversation being inner city conflict.
Right, right. And that, and to a degree, I think in the mainstream, the conversation around Black folks, African Americans, you know, was centered around that, you know, and nothing else. So, and then it was, you know, movies were, you know, Black movies were closely tied to hip hop at that time. You could argue now that Black movies aren't as closely tied to hip hop anymore, which is a positive to me, because I think that there should be that freedom there. But yeah, to answer your question, I think that it was a movie of its time. So. But we know, you know, that even though the zeitgeist isn't, the conversation right now isn't centered around those same issues as much as it was then, we know that those things are still happening. So that's my question, is that, okay, are we moving into a place where we have this unconventional storytelling going on that's going to become conventional almost?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is it leaving something behind? Or are we able to have both? Can we have, you know, a wide range of storytelling?
Well, I think nowadays it's probably essential to have both, because audiences consume information and art in such different ways and tastes are so different. Even just politically, I think like in the 90s, films like Menace, Juice, etc., people would see them for what they are. But now, are audiences ready to see that? Are they open to see that? Or do you have to sneak messaging in through the back door? Arguably, that's perhaps how Jordan Peele does it.
It's almost a question of what is going to make people uncomfortable in a positive way and what is going to make them uncomfortable in a point where they're not going to actually even pay attention to this because they're so uncomfortable that they don't want to engage in this. And so to me, I think that's where unconventional storytelling, using surrealism or using satire, that's kind of how that came to being. Like, I'm going to make you laugh.
Yeah, good point.
Or I'm going to make you, I'm going to kind of amaze you or make you fall in love with something from an artistic point of view, while at the same time, yeah, I'm sliding this point in, this very poignant thing in the back door and making you pay attention to it, kind of on the sly. And for Black filmmakers and people of color in general, for even for women, for female filmmakers, I think that these things are very useful tools for them to take advantage of, because we can stand and shout and scream about certain issues and never have anybody pay attention to us. Whereas when we entertain people, you know, when we kind of give them the Saturday Night Live treatment and entertain through satire, it's like, oh, they get engaged, and then all of a sudden they're learning something almost unwillingly. They're learning something.
Right.
But yeah.
I agree with all of that, especially the idea that things can sometimes be too subtle for people, and sometimes they need an extremity or an absurdity to bury the point home.
Yeah.
Like, I could imagine if Get Out had been done in a kind of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner way, I can imagine a lot of people watching that and making excuses for the racism. You know, no, but they like him. No, but they're being, you know, they're trying to be nice. No, but this, no, but that. And they would have missed the point in doing so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think one of the best parts, you know, and Sorry to Bother You is a film that at certain points did a very good job of using these unconventional methods of telling, explaining this narrative. And at other points, I think it kind of got a little bit repetitive, you know, and it was like, I got it. And then it just kept making the same point over and over again. But one of my favorite moments in that film was when Danny Glover's character kind of, you know, pulls the young dude to the side, pulls Lakeith Stanfield's character to the side and says, look, if you want to succeed here, mm-hmm. if you want to make some sales and succeed as a telemarketer, you need to use your white voice. And then immediately Lakeith Stanfield does imitation of what he thinks a white voice sounds like, you know, a very nasal thing. And Danny Glover says, no, I'm not just talking about the nasal. I'm talking about mm-hmm. you have to sound like you don't have a care in the world.
Right.
You have to sound like you got a Ferrari parked outside and this uh-huh. sale you about to make really don't even matter to
uh-huh.
you.
Uh-huh. You got to you know, feel
you're,
this.
You're
uh-huh.
right. You doing this dude a favor. You know, it's mm-hmm. like all these things that go into what being part of a dominant culture, what that kind of basically privilege, mm-hmm. you know, basically what it mm-hmm. means to be privileged. Mm-hmm. And I thought that Boots Riley did a really good job. He wrote the script. I thought he did a really good job of summing that up in that one scene and then saying, okay, so it's not just about how your voice sounds from an oral quality. It's basically how the emotion comes out of you. And that's what means being white in America. That's what that means.
And nice touch that the actual quote unquote white voice that he does successfully use is not a voice voiced by Lakeith Stanfield, the actor. It's voiced by a completely different actor. What I liked about that in not getting him to impersonate was mm-hmm. it truly was not an impersonation, which was Danny Glover's point. Mm-hmm. It's got to be real.
And that to me was a perfect use of, you know, that was a combination of surrealism and satire. That was, but you know,
absolutely.
Again, that was a perfect use of that in order to get that point across that had you just done that in a more conventional sense, I can't say it wouldn't have been as effective, but I really liked it in that context and how, you know, Boots used those tools to get that point across. So to me, that type of storytelling is very necessary. Mm-hmm. My worry, though, is that we as I'm gonna say we as people of color filmmakers, even though I'm not a filmmaker, but just we as people of color creators, we aren't going to be able to keep what we had and then keep moving into a new area. It's almost like we're leaving behind something. So we talked about in a previous episode of this show why people go to the movies and what it means for them to see themselves represented on screen. So I can see a lot of people going to certain movies like, you know, what were you guys just talking about? Us or Beale Street or any of these films or watching Atlanta on television or Dear White People and connecting to the characters they see on screen. Mm-hmm. But then I can also see another crowd going and connecting more to what they saw in the 90s. You know what I'm saying? With those films, whether it be Boys in the Hood or Juice or any of the other films that came out in that time period. So my worry is that...
Or even The Wire, right?
Or even The Wire. So my worry is that we are... It's kind of like we're getting a certain freedom to expand and have more opportunities in the stories that we're telling. But at the same time, we're leaving behind a certain part of story or storytelling or a certain part of a certain tool.
Did films like Menace, Boys, Juice, Straight Out of Brooklyn, did they become unfashionable? And I don't mean to, you know, our type of demographic. I'm thinking about the broader populace. The reason I ask is because a little while after those came out, the Wayans brothers came out with a movie called Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood. And it was, I guess, a parody of those movies. Kind of, you know, kind of like the Airplane movies were. And even the Wayans' own scary movie franchise was. And anyway, in the movie, Keenan Ivory Wayans, he pops up as a variety of roles. He pops up as a postman, as a bystander, as a baby in a cot at one point. And it's always when another character is saying something very, very dramatic, very, very profound, like, oh my God, life is so hard because X, or oh my God, you know, I can't believe we've got to go through this because X. And at those times, Keenan Ivory, the character that Keenan Ivory Wayans is playing, he pops up and he's like, message. It's as if they were pointing a finger at those movies saying, you're being too heavy-handed. You're being too, this is too raw. We get it. We got the picture. I love those movies. But do you think that hyper-reality started to be seen as, this is a little too much. This is now, we get it. This is corny. This is unfashionable.
Yeah, you mean the hyper-reality of the menace to societies and boys and hoods, etc.
Correct.
Well, that story. Correct. Exactly. That story. Correct. And yeah. I agree with that. Chris Rock even had a film directed by Tamra Davis and produced by Nelson George, CB4, you know, about a fictitious gangster rap group that kind of had the same kind of satirical, you know, in your face, on the nose approach to its storytelling. You know, and I think that that people got tired of seeing and hearing and you know, just as gangster rap, so-called gangster rap, you know, evolved into something else, so did these kinds of films. There's this sort of this same kind of storyline. You know, Isaac, you had said earlier, hey, could Menace to Society be remade? Like, could somebody remake it now? And I said, well, yeah, but you'd have to make it in another city. Like, you had to make it in Chicago, and it's not necessarily about, you know, Crips and Bloods. That which is, you know, what Menace to Society is. And Boys in the Hood, this abstracted Crips and Bloods story, without actually naming, you know, these two gangs or street organizations.
That's an interesting point, because we all expected Chi-Raq to be that movie, right?
But
in the end, it was more of a kind of stroke surrealist satire.
Mm-hmm.
I think though, in that vein, I'm glad you guys brought that up, because I think in that vein, I see a certain freedom, just the devil's advocate for the freedom that, you know, Black filmmakers and people of color filmmakers in general seem to be moving towards now, because those films that you're talking about, Arthur, the films that, you know, centered around gang culture in Southern California at that time, because also remember there was Colors, there was other films that were made not by Black filmmakers,
right? That was a white savior film,
right? Exactly.
Colors, with the Richie Cunningham lookalike gang member. Now that's surreal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you had those films, but they seem like they were dictated again by not just the zeitgeist, but by the popular headlines at the time, what the media was focusing on, what the corporate media was focusing on. So now it feels like what Jordan Peele is doing and to a degree what Barry Jenkins is doing, and, you know, what Ava DuVernay did prior when she was doing independent films, it feels like they have the more autonomy. They're telling the stories that they want to tell, which is something to be celebrated. When you look at the 90s and that sort of more quote unquote conventional storytelling, you're looking at the result of films and a conversation that was kind of signed off on by mainstream. Like, okay. Those, you know, you want to talk about gang culture and everything that's going on in Southern California, cool. You know what I'm saying? That's approved. Now what we're looking at is, I think, a reaction to the fact that for so long we haven't been able to get the stories that we want to tell approved. So now we've turned to an unconventional way of telling these stories.
Right.
Let's use satire, let's use a surrealist approach, let's use horror, you know, to get these things in through the back door. So my question is, okay, are we going to continue to do that? Where is this going? Are we going to continue making all these unconventional type films? Are we going to be able to get into more conventional storytelling? is, you know, even comedy to a certain degree, in my opinion, comedy has been a way to get our stories in through the back door. So celebrating, you know, I celebrate Crazy Rich Asians, comedy, romance comedy film.
Right.
How long before we're going to see a Asian led cast in a drama or a action film? You know, how long before that happens? You know, I think these are questions that we should, as we're kind of celebrating or we're kind of looking at where this thing is going. I think these are questions because, listen, we posed this question at the beginning of this episode about what's happening now, the unconventional versus the more conventional. The one advantage that conventional storytelling and hard hitting and hyper reality filmmaking has, or any type of storytelling has, is that kick in the chest you get, you mm-hmm. know, with a Boys in the Hood, when old boy dies, you know, yeah. When what's Ricky. My man's Ricky dies, you know, there's nothing that really, you know, that kick in the chest is that impact that you get really can't be, there's no abstraction to that. You know, there's no ambiguity to that. It's just raw. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that should supplant what happens in Sorry to Bother You or what happens in Us or Get Out. But I think that's needed. You know, that raw kick in the chest is always needed. So I would hate to see that go away completely. And then all we can do is, you know, kind of the unconventional storytelling that we're doing now.
I mean, mm-hmm. there's no doubt art mm-hmm. suffers when there's a lack of variation in approach and vision. For great art to evolve, you need that spectrum. Something I love about Barry Jenkins' work is so far he's given it all a unique identity. Like if Beale Street Could Talk, it draws from a pool that's not too different from Menace or Boys in terms of the storyline or material, like, you know, the everyday experience of everyday people, but he gives it to you through such a unique lens. He has a fantastic eye. I think he's got incredible timing. I think he can find resonance in the simplest things. I'm probably overdoing it, but...
You love him. You love him. You adore him.
Right. I guess I do. He gives it to you from a perspective that you wouldn't normally see things. And I very, very much value that. So If Beale Street Could Talk is based on the James Baldwin novel, and it tells a story of racism through a veneer that we don't normally see it. It's very, very sensitive, subtle treatment of it. The performances are fantastic. The cinematography is phenomenal, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I just loved everything about it.
I think about Barry Jenkins and I think about Ava DuVernay mm-hmm. as... the two, and let me ask you, if Beale Street Could Talk, it wasn't a surrealist movie.
No, not at all. Not at all. But it's an art house movie. You know, I hate using that term.
It's a gorgeous movie.
You ever read the book? Like, Jisek, have you ever read the book?
In college, about a million years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, me too. I want to read it again.
So, but here's my question though. If I look at Ava DuVernay and I look at Barry Jenkins and then I take what they've done, and I take what Jordan Peele is doing. Mm-hmm. So Get Out versus If Beale Street Could Talk. These are two films about racism, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Get Out takes place present day. Beale Street, that's the 70s, I believe, right?
Correct, yeah.
So Get Out in the present day is using horror as the device. Beale Street is not a horror, it's not surreal, it's not using a device, so it's more of a linear type storytelling, more so in lines of what we had in the past, correct? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's not strictly linear in its narrative. It does jump around a little bit.
Yeah, but it's more conventional
time wise, like in a kind of True Detective type way.
Right, but it's far more conventional than say
Yeah, it's not absurdist in any it's not fantastic in any mm-hmm. way.
So who is going to tell stories of racism in present day 2019 without using satire or surrealism or horror? You know, who is going to tell a straightforward drama, you know, in that? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you see what I'm getting to? It's like, again, are we getting pigeonholed? Are we getting into where we're kind of feeling like, oh, we're getting all these freedoms to use all these different tools, mm-hmm. but then we're moving away from stories that were told, and not just the 90s, 80s, 70s, where it was a more impactful, straightforward, you know, boom, this is what it is.
That's a good question. But what surprises me is that we haven't seen a raft of new films springing out of or following the Black Lives Matter movement.
Right.
Like, after all these extrajudicial killings and all the publicity that they've received, I'm surprised that we're not seeing more. I mean, I haven't seen it, but maybe Blindspotting qualifies.
Right. Blindspotting, nowhere near in the realm of a Sorry to Bother You in terms of surrealism, but they do have a, I believe there's a moment almost maybe at the apex of the film where it doesn't turn into a musical, but it does. I think it breaks the fourth wall, maybe. I'm not sure. But there is a level of the surreal somewhere in that film. But that's, I think it's good to bring that up. But more to the point, I'm talking about, if you look at Ava DuVernay, just to use her as an example, prior to becoming, you know, as big as she's become, if you look at some of her earlier films, Middle of Nowhere, to be specific, is she ever going to be able to do that again? Because right now she's gone. She's done Selma. She's done some great documentaries. Mm-hmm. Right now she's working on a comic book film, which, you know, I have no issue with. Right. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah. I mean, she just dropped, Netflix are just about to drop her telling of the Central Park Five story, right?
Right, right. So yeah, another documentary. Then she did big budget Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
And now she's big budget for this New Gods film.
Right.
So is she, you know, can she, even with all the power that she has now, could she go to Hollywood with a Middle of Nowhere type movie and say, this is what I want to do? You know, and I want $80 to $90 million from you to do this.
Right. Or could Ryan Coogler do the same for another Fruitvale Station?
Exactly. Exactly. You know,
one would assume, right? One would assume with the more power you have, the more ability you have to greenlight projects. Omar Dorsey, a Hollywood actor, and he recently appeared on our Denzel Effect episode. He was talking about the one for me, one for you concept, where actors could do a studio piece and then perhaps they could get funding for a passion project.
Mm-hmm.
But he was specifically talking about actors. Yeah. So I'm wondering, can a director and can a producer, you know, go to the studios now? Can Ava do that? You know, can Ryan has the largest African-American, you know, mostly African or African-American cast movie, made the most money of any in history. Can he go to Hollywood? You would think, to John's point, he should be able to go to Hollywood and be like, yo,
and name his
price. I want a blank check with $100 million on it. I'll tell you later what the movie is about, you know? And somehow I feel like he wouldn't be able to do that.
Could a massively powerful white director do it?
Dude, James Cameron right now. And look, not to put Ryan Coogler on James Cameron's level, because obviously James Cameron has a much longer track record. He's made some of the most successful films in history. But the man has basically got a blank check. He's making like 5 sequels, been working on them to Avatar, been working on them forever. Mm-hmm. Budgets are through the roof, whatever. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, but firstly, Cameron does action movies only, basically. And he does a lot of them, and he's done a lot of them, and they've all been very, very successful. He's probably not the right example, because he's one of the most successful directors working in Hollywood. But so he can probably do anything. But I guess I'm asking, how differently would a white director on Coogler's level be treated?
Yeah, I think, and I, you know, actually, I mean, to be honest, James Cameron may be a bad example again, because he's so huge. But I get what you're saying. You're saying, is he pigeonholed into making huge big budget films? I think at this point, for James Cameron
that's
in particular,
not so much what I'm asking. I'm asking more than that. Have we got back to the point where studios are comfortable with smaller material, and specifically, have we got to the point where studios, the money men, the people who actually fund this stuff, where they're comfortable with smaller stories about the African American experience, or the Latino experience, or the Indian experience? Have we got to that point where a Fruitvale Station or a Middle of Nowhere can be made with a bigger budget?
I think it has to do with the presumption of audience support for the project.
Agreed.
Which equates to money, but I'm saying, It could be, well, hey, James Cameron, hey, Ryan, I don't have a problem with you spending $100 million on, you know, the Attica prison riot, make another Dog Day Afternoon with an all-black cast. Is the audience going to support it? I don't think so. And then the conversation stops right there. Or parameters are put on the project. Well, I won't give you $100 million, I'll give you $50 million, and we'll just do major market releases. We're not going to do it across the board. We'll start it off in, you know, LA.
I think at this point that $100 million could be given to a small concept, as long as it to connect it back to what we've been talking about. If it connects back to a horror movie or a surreal or a satire, I think that's the way it could happen now. In other words, to John's point, I think, because John, you're basically saying, can I take a small concept like the central focus of Get Out and, you know, get $100 million for it to make that movie? Yes, I think that can happen.
Can I make a real version of Get Out, like without the fantasy?
No, I don't think so. I think the horror element, to be clear
for the audience, not every film needs $100 million budget. We're not talking about necessarily taking that money and putting it on the screen, but putting it into marketing is the key, right? Can a studio get behind one of these films, truly behind one of these films?
No, and to be fair, in this climate, I think it's difficult for any movie with a quote-unquote small concept that's not a big budget popcorn movie to get $100 million. You know, I don't care what it, I don't care white, black, you know, Latino, Asian,
and
whatever.
Dramas in particular are very hard to come by nowadays.
Right.
Let's be real though. How many people do you know who saw If Beale Street Could Talk or Moonlight versus how many people saw Black Panther?
Yeah, there's no argument there. I see where you're going. Yeah, there's no argument there. We are a culture of big budget.
And even how many people are actually interested, like really interested, will go and see If Beale Street Could Talk or Moonlight?
Well, yeah, but that's the, and I'm not discrediting what you're saying, but that's sort of like the concept of popular music against the concept of good music. Yeah, that's as old as time.
But just to be thorough, looking at the box office of these two films that we were just talking about, Beale Street was had a production budget of around $12 million. Worldwide it made $20 million, so they made profit off that film. Moonlight had a production budget of around $4 million. It made $65 million worldwide, so that's huge.
Yeah, that's that Oscar profit. Buzz, right? But
right, so,
but listen, if you're looking on Wikipedia at the budget versus the box office, that does not tell the whole story, because what isn't disclosed there is the marketing budget. So when these big films get made, their marketing budgets, you know, for around the world marketing, they often equal the production budget, right? I think that's a key point here, is in a studio's belief of whether or not a demographic is going to go and see a film or going to invest in a film. They ask themselves, okay, do we now cut it here? Or do we go and say, yeah, we're going to really push this. We're going to really get this into people's magazines and onto their apps, onto their websites, etc. We're going to make sure that people know this film is out. And you know, just to be clear, regardless of the race, smaller films of any kind are almost non-existent nowadays.
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of this episode, we took this quote-unquote movement, what's happening right now, and we kind of pitted it against what was happening in the 90s with those more conventional films. And to me, and I want to hear you guys' opinion on this, but to me it feels like there was constraint back then in what black filmmakers could do. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel some constraint after this conversation I've had with you guys. I feel there's some constraint now, because I really don't know if, to go back to my earlier example, if Ava could do a middle of nowhere with a big budget right now. I don't feel like she could do that. I don't feel like Ryan Coogler could get big budget to do a Fruitvale Station. So I'm wondering, you know, we pitted these two things against each other and said which one is doing a better job or does a better job of representing our stories. To me, that answer is simple. I think both of them are necessary to tell the full range of stories. But the kind of the spinoff question from that is, can we do that? Can we have both? And from a creative standpoint, yes, we could do that. But from a getting things greenlit in Hollywood standpoint, I feel like we're moving in a different direction, but we're dealing with the same constraints that we had before.
Yeah. I do want to mention, though, that I think constraints aside, I would imagine, and it seemed to me, the Hughes brothers, Singleton, Spike Lee, Ernest Dickerson, they were passionate about what they were doing. I don't think they saw it necessarily as a limitation. I think that these were stories that they really wanted to tell. I mean, Singleton
I'm not saying the filmmakers were limited in their creative scope. I'm saying that Hollywood at that point in time really only wanted to see those types of films.
Got it.
In other words, after Boys in the Hood hit, you needed to come to Hollywood with a Boys in the Hood script. You know, you wasn't coming with a Get Out script. You know, so
because that's what the audience would go and see.
Right. And not just the black audience. I think Boys in the Hood, maybe Boys in the Hood more than Menace to Society, but it crossed over a little bit. It got more than the black audience. So, and Get Out definitely got more than the black audience. So I'm wondering, could Jordan Peele...
You could probably have gone to Hollywood with a Get Out script back then, but it would have had to have starred Brad Pitt and Gina Davis.
or it would have had to have been straight... I don't know. It may have had to have been like making fun of horror in the way that Robert Townsend, the Wayans brothers made fun of the gangster flicks, you know. But I mean, I really am interested in you guys' take on, you know, are we, again, to bring this back to the beginning? We've answered the central question, but the new question, are we in a new area of constraint? Or are we in the danger of being in a new area of constraint? Because I don't know, maybe tomorrow a movie will be announced. That kind of blows off, you know, answers my question.
Another way might be to ask whether the filmmakers doing this kind of thing, whether they have golden handcuffs on.
Right. Because Jordan Peele has a broad following now, you know, very multicultural following right now. If his next film isn't horror, isn't satire, surreal at all, if it is a, you know, straight linear, more in the vein of a Boys in the Hood or something like that, is he going to maintain that, you know, is he going to maintain that audience?
I think he could. I think he can maintain that audience with whatever his next film is going to be. He's going to maintain that audience.
It's funny, even the marketing of Us is actually marketing Jordan Peele as much as it's marketing the movie, because it's not a film by Jordan Peele or directed by Jordan Peele. It's from the mind of Jordan Peele in a way that, you know, it really sells you on the fact that he's a creative force.
Right. Are you saying that they're trying to position that as being an auteur?
The marketing is to water him down? Because where I'm going to, okay, is like, okay, well, where's the threat? Where's the threat of Jordan Peele's next movie? Where's the threat of, when you talk about golden handcuffs, why do you have handcuffs on? Well, because I'm afraid of... What's the threat?
Well, I think that connects to what Jahan just said, that at this moment, Jordan Peele has been positioned as an auteur. You know, it's not just in the same way that Quentin Tarantino is. It's not just about a random film. It's like, it's not even just about the movie. It's about his ideology. You know what I'm saying? So you're going to this theater to ingest a little bit more of the way he sees the world, or what he wants to tell you about the way he sees the world. And I like that. You know, I think that's a positive. I think that it's notable, though, that after the success of Get Out, Jordan Peele was offered Akira. Okay, so, and he was offered a lot of money. I think that was like budgeted to be like $150 million movie, you know. So Akira, for anyone who doesn't know, is a iconic Japanese anime, classic, iconic film. And Hollywood has been trying to make a live action version of this movie forever, which they probably shouldn't do. That's another episode, but I don't think it's going to translate well.
That's surreal.
Yes, yeah, it's surreal. And I think that there's so much Japanese culture in that film that to westernize it, I think would be a huge mistake. I think it's notable that he was offered that after Get Out success. Hollywood does what it often does. It tried to reward him by corralling him. In other words, you know, here, come on, be a part of this group, but, you know, don't do that shit you were doing before. Here's some new stuff, and we'll give you a lot of money to do it. And he said no. And so that says right there that he's very much intent upon, you know, delivering what's in his mind, you know, like John just said, from the mind of Jordan Peele. He's not interested in delivering from someone else's point of view. It's from his mind. So, and I, you know, I have no issue with that. But he may be, he may be putting the handcuffs on himself, mm-hmm. but is it any different than the handcuff that M. Night Shyamalan put on himself? You know, as far as like, okay, now he has to tell this certain type of storytelling.
He has to deliver a final scene, big twist. Deliver a final scene. Movie.
M. Night, who is a person of color, but his films don't revolve around those issues. Mm-hmm. But again, so I put him more of a mainstream context. Mm-hmm. But again, he had the handcuffs put on himself, and he had to deliver that movie every time. And sometimes it failed, sometimes it succeeded. I see Jordan in that light now. But the added component, because in what makes him different than M. Night is that Jordan is telling stories based on a racial point of view, or class, racial, you know, point of view. So he has an added handcuff there where it's like, okay, can he go outside of that now? You know, even if he wanted to do, let's say he wanted to do another, you know, a horror film that had nothing to do with race and class, I think he could get that greenlit. But I think everybody, especially us, meaning black folks, would be like, yo, man, what the fuck? You know what I'm saying? You're supposed to be telling these type of stories now. Mm-hmm. You know, why are you over here doing that?
All right, let's do the round table. In the spirit of Jordan Peele's Us, this round table is called Me and You. What film character is your doppelganger? And just to be clear, you know, a doppelganger is it's an apparition or a double of a living person. So you looking at you. Yeah, so just to be clear, the doppelganger doesn't have to look like you. You don't have to think of a film character that looks like you. So, you know, there have been several people that say that believe that I look like Matt Damon. I mean, people that I've known for a while.
What are you talking about?
I'm dead serious. I'm dead serious.
The fuck? So it doesn't have to be your physical, your twin. You're talking about a doppelganger in the sense that their personalities or what they do in the film or their journey or their narrative, blah, 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 blah.
Right. And there may be some characteristics about them that either
remind you of yourself.
That reminds you of yourself. Maybe you don't manifest, but it's in you.
Okay.
And in the spirit of Us, this is about us taking a look at our real selves here, right? This is not about me saying, oh yeah, Denzel Washington reminds me of myself in all his most heroic roles.
Yes, you can get, this is a very...
I just had a vision of Jahan in the glory scene where he's just...
That single tear. Listen, bro, every time someone tells me something about music that I'm like, what? I have that single tear. That silent single tear. No, you should not be listening to that.
That is hilarious.
No, that is not a good album. No, they are single not tier. A good artist. No, she cannot sing. No, she cannot play. Single tier each single time. Tier. Single tier. Oh, I'm only joking.
So my doppelganger would be Bugging Out from Do the Right Thing, played by Giancarlo Esposito, 1989.
I'm interested in hearing this. Go ahead.
Well, you know, lighter shade of brown, wears glasses. Heavy prescription on the glasses.
Jordan's
sneaker game. Yep. Sneaker game.
Just get to the part you want to get to. You the type of motherfucker to roll up into somebody's pizza joint and yell.
That's right. That's right. Social activist. Why the fuck aren't there brothers up on this wall? Right.
That's the part. Yeah. Right. Hold on, though. What about the scene with the dude from Boston who stepped on his sneakers? Was that you back in the day?
That was in me.
Okay, but you never actually snapped off like that.
Not like that. I'm a nice guy, diplomatic, conciliatory, polite. But there are times when I just want to go and just snap off by things that I don't agree with. You scuff my sneakers, you know, why you leaning on my car? Stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Why ain't there no brothers up on the wall?
Why ain't there no brothers up on the wall? And Bugging Out was aggressive. But his aggression wasn't because he wanted to dominate a situation. His aggression was because he wanted to have someone acknowledge that what was important to him should be important to that person.
Yeah, it was his, it wasn't aggression. It was a reaction to what he felt was an invasion upon, you know, spaces that he felt were not reserved to a certain extent, but, you know, occupied by his people. And so when you had the dude from Boston step on his shoes, the reaction came from not just because you just scuffed up my Jordans, but, you know, why are you here? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that was the gentrification thing, right?
Right, right. And then with Sal, it's like, okay, you know, you in our neighborhood, you know, we support you.
Your why don't business. You represent anything? You ain't about representing the us up on your walls,
you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Sal, of course, is like, yo, you open up your shop, you can put all the brothers up on the wall that you want. But that missed the point of, like, you're in a neighborhood that, you know, is largely not Italians, and we're supporting you. Why are you not representing us? So. Yeah, I can see that from you. I can see that from you. I actually could see you snapping off somebody stepping on your sneakers back then, you know, when you were a younger man and more impulsive. I could see that. Are they losing this? But, you know, it's always the quiet dudes when they lose their shit. That's when it gets really ugly. You know what I'm saying? Right. When they lose it, that's when it's serious, when it gets real serious. I really feel that the true answer to this question is, there's a multitude of characters that we all connect to, and we connect to them because we either see a part of ourselves in them or we see something that we would like to be, you know, in them. So if I think back to my favorite characters throughout all the movies I watched, the ones that I've liked the most are the ones that I couldn't really escape. Like, I thought about them and I couldn't stop thinking about them. That's because I saw something of them. I saw something of me in them. Or to a degree, I understood something about them. You know, when you see a character in a movie and they get misunderstood by a lot of people throughout the film, but you understand them, then that creates a strong connection between you and that character. So there's a multitude of characters, and they aren't all heroes. They aren't even all protagonists, but there's a multitude of characters I can name. But the most obvious was from a film that we discussed, and we did an episode about this movie maybe a year or so ago. On Valentine's Day, the film was Love Jones. The
Darius,
the central.
You gonna tell me Darius is your
the central? Not just so I can be with Nia Long. But anyway, the central character, male character of that film. There's two. There's a male and female character. The central characters that film, but Lorenz Tate's character, Darius Lovehall. When the film came out, I felt that connection and that kind of, like, you know, mirroring of my own self in him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then it's like, at the time that film came out, I think it was 97. I moved to Chicago the next year in 98. And Darius Lovehall in the film was a writer living on the south side of Chicago, had worked for New City Magazine, mm-hmm. Left New City Magazine to write a novel. Mm-hmm. In 1998, I was a writer living on the south side of Chicago, working for New City Magazine. But Darius in the film was a writer for New City Magazine. When I came out of college, got hired by New City, they hired me as a selling ads, which is not my forte at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not a salesman in the slightest, but I needed a job. So
you adapted.
And I wanted to get my foot in the door any way I could. So I did that. But it was ironic later on when I found out, you know, it was kind of like, it wasn't on purpose. I didn't go to work for them because I saw in the movie that he did, but it just happened that way. Mm-hmm. They filmed a scene from Love Jones in New City, but it got cut out of the movie, which was just kind of surreal to me. But his whole journey throughout that film and some of the things that happened to him, I related to. We were around the same age at that time, early 20s. And yeah, he was at that point in time. There's a couple people, Shannon for one, a mutual friend of me and Arthur's, who, you know, kind of referred to me, you know, as Darius Lovehall. Shannon was Savon, and as you can, you know, that makes sense to you, Arthur. And I was Darius. So if I had to think of any character that really kind of mirrored me in a very literal sense, it would be him. But again, to my earlier point, I think that I could sit down and just like write out a list of all the characters who I've, you know, throughout cinema, who I kind of feel a connection to.
It was a good one.
All right. Well, my doppelganger is a bit different. It's not a person, but it does have physical representations in the way that it creates and manufactures physical representations and proxies, but it's bigger than that. It's much bigger than that. It was created for a noble purpose, but once it was created, it started learning at a geometric rate. On August the 29th, 1997, at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, my doppelganger achieved full self-awareness. My doppelganger is, from the Terminator franchise, the artificial intelligence system, Skynet.
Oh my God.
Well, that is a full lid on this episode of Snobs on Film. Our Instagram handle is Snobs on Film. Our Twitter handle is Snobs on Film. And our website, wait for it, snobsonfilm.com. The show library is found anywhere that quality podcasts are distributed. We encourage you to give us a rating and even leave a comment in iTunes. We're available on Spotify and Stitcher and Google Podcasts. Good Lord, 2-3 other different places that I can't remember for right now. And we also encourage you to listen to our sister show, The Music Snobs. Current episode is on the 25th anniversary of the debut of Outkast with our guest snob, Keisha Jackson.
I mean, you know what the biggest problem for me is with Us and Get Out? We would have survived that shit. You know what they look like. They are you. You know their weakness.
Right. You know what they look like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not like you're trying to... We're not trying to identify an unknown assailant here. Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Keep it coming. I can feel you, baby.